Welcome to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. I'm Russ White. At 6 past the hour, following the latest news, holiday food safety tips and eating trends, selecting, caring for, and properly disposing of your real Michigan Christmas tree.
The message we're really working on right now is really a three-step idea, and it's this notion of fresh tree, fresh cut, fresh water.
And why endowed chairs and professorships are so important to MSU's future.
This is the quality of the institution. This is the ultimate investment. This is the way in which we assure that quality continues in this place. Chairs and professorships really change the quality of the institution.
That and more begins at 4:06. You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, a safe, secure food supply is essential to sustainability, and safety considerations do not end once we bring food home from the grocery store or the farmer's market. During the holiday season, food safety can present even greater challenges. To help us meet those challenges is Joyce McGarry. Joyce is the MSU Extension Food Safety Educator. Joyce, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
Joyce, the importance of food safety in general, I mentioned that in my open, but there are some statistics from the Center for Disease Control. I mean, there is a lot of foodborne illness in the United States each year.
And it seems to be increasing because of our variety of food and where we get our food, and a lot of it's education. Mm-hmm. So that's what MSU Extension does out in our communities, is help to help for consumers to understand how to handle their food safely, how to prepare it and store it safely.
That's why they call you educators.
That's true.
I really like that when Extension went from agents to educators, because education is really the mission of MSU Extension.
It certainly is, and we do reach a lot of areas in the state that that appreciate our services.
Well, let's get to some of these precautions that folks can take, not only during the holidays, but the rest of the year when it comes to food safety. A few tips here in the time that we have, Joyce.
Well, I think the first tip, and the very most important one, is always washing your hands, especially as we're coming into flu season. That is such an important part of keeping your food safe, is washing hands, simple as can be. The next one is making sure that your food is kept at the proper temperatures. So cold food's cold and hot food's hot for any short amount of time, no more than 2 hours. So sometimes, as we know, time goes fast and things sit out a little bit longer. So that's one reason we bring awareness that you really need to put your food, either freeze it or refrigerate it after you have eaten, and then you can enjoy the rest of your meal. But anything that needs to be hot or cold should not be sitting out for more than 2 hours.
Now, using a thermometer when you're heating food is essential. A lot of people do that. A lot of people don't.
Unfortunately, it's one of those tools that kind of sit in the drawer and don't get used a lot. But we are really trying hard through Extension to talk about using food thermometers. It's not only a way to keep your food safe, but it's also a quality issue, so you don't overcook or undercook. But using thermometers is a habit that you really need to practice more often, and it is certainly one that we are helping consumers to understand.
Josh, you mentioned storage of food after it's been out. Some people like to use their garages for food storage. Not a good idea, right?
No, unfortunately, no. That's not a good idea. The fluctuation of temperatures does not keep it consistent. Remember, your refrigerator at 40 degrees or lower and your freezer at 0 degrees or lower. And you cannot guarantee that will happen in a garage.
One thing, I mentioned safety when you get the food home from the store, but there are some things people need to look out for when they're actually in a farmer's market or a grocery store with respect to food safety.
Oh, of course, of course. And as you're traveling, especially in the grocery stores with frozen and cold foods, that they should be purchased at the end of your shopping trip, right before you're ready to check out, because they do start to thaw and come to room temperature. Farmers markets the same way, making sure that what you're buying is kept cold if it needs to be. Another tip that we are helping people to understand is our reusable grocery bags need to be washed on occasion. You put your food in there on a regular basis. It's very important to keep those clean for every shopping trip.
Let's go back to farmers markets because, you know, there's a lot of interest in locally produced food. Farmers markets have popped up everywhere. They're very successful. What about food? You know, you might talk to a vendor and they'll say, well, you know, we've washed the apples or we've washed the vegetables or what have you. Are there some things in particular with farmers markets that people have to be careful about?
Well, we always tell people to wash their produce and wash their fruit when they get home or before they eat it. And then some of the challenges are it doesn't keep as long if you wash it. So another tip is do not wash it until you're ready to prepare or eat it. Mm-hmm. It will keep longer in your refrigerator. But it is important to always wash your fruits and vegetables, even if it's been pre-washed before you've bought it.
My guest is Joyce McGarry. She's the MSU Extension Food Safety Educator. When we're washing our fruits and vegetables, though, we wash it in cold water, warm water? How do we wash them?
Cold water, cold running water right over the top of it. If it's a tough skin like apples and oranges and things like that, you just you can use a vegetable brush to clean it. The softer, more things like tomatoes and things, just keep it under cold running water. And wash it thoroughly.
A lot of people like turkey over the holidays, and you mentioned buy your frozen foods last in the store so that they don't thaw on the way home. But in terms of preparing frozen turkey, for example, are there some things that people need to watch out for?
Well, you need to plan ahead, obviously, for frozen turkey to make sure that it's going to be thawed in time for you to cook it. And we only suggest three safe ways to thaw foods. And one is in the microwave. And that's a little difficult sometimes with turkey to determine when it's thawed. Anything in a microwave that is thawed needs to be cooked immediately because, as we know, it does start to cook in that microwave. We also have the cold water method, which you put it in the sink with a cold running water over it and keeping that temperature at 70 degrees and changing the water every 30 minutes. And that's a very safe method. The other, of course, is planning ahead and refrigerating. So a turkey takes about 24 hours for every 5 pounds. Mm. So okay. You do need to plan ahead.
What about dressing in the turkey or separately?
That's always been our challenge when people call, and it's such a hard thing to tell people not to stuff your turkey. Mm. You can stuff your turkey. You just have to make sure that the temperature of the stuffing is 165 degrees, as well as the turkey being 165 degrees. So both have to be checked. It is recommended that you keep the stuffing separate from the turkey. But we all know that traditions are very important to people. So as long as you have your food thermometer checking that stuffing temperature at 165, it should be safe.
Well, a lot of people put a thermometer, as you know, in the turkey, but maybe don't do the stuffing part of it. So you'd probably need a separate thermometer just to check that as you're watching the thermometer that's stuck in the turkey.
That's true. An instant read thermometer works very well to check that stuffing temperature. And we don't always trust the little pop-up thermometers that are part of the turkey either. We do suggest that you use an actual meat thermometer that can be kept in the turkey throughout the baking time.
Now, you mentioned the importance of washing hands. What about utensils? What about countertops?
Of course. Cleaning and sanitizing is very important. And, of course, keeping pets out of your kitchen is important, too. But also...
That's a tough one.
It is a tough one. And also, if you have family members that may be sick, not feeling well, they should not be part of the food preparation either. It's kind of a difficult situation to handle, but it is recommended if you are sick and not feeling well not to be handling the food.
And I want to come back and reiterate a point. During the holidays, a lot of people at the house, food can get left out longer than it might normally do during the routine of the rest of the year. But back to that point again about how long food should be left out.
2 hours is what we recommend in a regular 70-degree house. Mm-hmm. No longer than that. So if you are sitting enjoying your meal, you know, just take a moment to put things away, refrigerate it. You can freeze your leftovers, and certainly you can have them later, a couple months later, or your leftovers will last about 3 to 4 days in the refrigerator.
Well, all this talk about food and food preparation is kind of making me hungry. Certainly that's okay during the holidays. But Joyce, where can folks, I know that MSU Extension puts out a lot of great information about food safety and food security. Where can folks go to get that information?
We have several sites you can go to. One is called Ask the Expert through MSU Extension. Another is the MSU Extension website, where we publish articles throughout the year. And it would be very timely to have ones on food safety during the holidays.
Yeah, and I read two or three of the articles that have just come out recently and to prepare for this interview. They're excellent, and the tips are just fantastic, very easy to put together. Congrats to you and your team for that educational information.
Thank you so much. And we know it's just to raise awareness. We all realize what can happen, the potentials. So just to be aware of food safety during these times is very important.
So always educating, MSU Extension. I've been talking with Joyce McGarry. She is the MSU Extension Food Safety Educator. Joyce, pleasure having you back on Greening the Great Lakes.
Thank you so much.
WKAR. Tune to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Kirk Heinze.
Moving into the holiday season, and that means our annual visit with resident Christmas tree expert, Dr. Bert Craig, who is a professor in Michigan State University's Department of Horticulture and Department of Forestry. He also has an appointment with our good friends at MSU Ag Bio and MSU Extension. You know, Bert, given the weather we've been having in November, many are just getting around to even thinking about colder weather and Christmas.
Yeah, it's been slow to come around, but you know it'll get here eventually, and
that's for sure.
and it certainly has some impacts for our producers. One of the things that happens is we actually like having some colder weather earlier. It helps the trees in terms of needle set, and also for the growers as they're storing their trees. They actually start harvest as early as late October, so they've already been cutting trees for a while. Michigan Christmas trees go throughout the Midwest, even down into Texas and Florida. So in order to just for the logistics of it, you know, they start harvesting a pretty good ways out. And so that can be an issue. It's really kind of a dual-edged sword, if you will. With the warmer weather, it makes the harvesting and things easier. They're not mucking around in the snow and the mud and everything else. But as I mentioned, it does potentially have some impacts on the needle retention. But the growers are aware of this, and so what they do is they'll typically harvest things first, like Fraser fir and Scotch pines, things that they know are going to hang on to their needles, and then they kind of work their way down to maybe white spruce or some things that may have some needle retention issues. And so I think people should have a good experience no matter where they get their tree.
There was some concern, and we actually talked to a couple of local growers here, but that was real dry there, I believe, in June. And there was some concern. Normally, the dry weather doesn't have a tune, but it was getting so dry that not only field crops, but Christmas trees were beginning to be impacted.
Yeah, it was. It was that combination of dry weather and also very warm. Usually, the biggest impact on that is for the new transplants. So they're planting their new trees in the spring, little seedlings that they'll transplant. And those are pretty susceptible to dry weather. And, of course, right after you plant them, they haven't had their roots established and all of that. The rains came just in time for a lot of things this year, and that includes our Christmas trees. I'm not aware of people losing, you know, established trees, probably some, you know, transplants that they'll have to come back in. And they can usually go back in and replant. You know, if they lose some trees here and there, they'll go back and replant. And then those trees, you know, will more or less catch up by the time they're ready for harvest, you know.
So the good news is that going into this Christmas tree season, people are still going to have a lot of good, sturdy trees to choose from. Let's remind our listeners out there, what are some tips when they go out and cut those trees and bring them home?
Yeah. The message we're really working on right now through the various associations and so on is really a three-step idea, and it's this notion of fresh tree, fresh cut, fresh water. Mm. And so the idea there is making sure you get as fresh a tree as possible. Michigan's got a great number of choose and cut farms. So obviously if you're cutting the tree yourself, you
can't get much fresher.
You can't get any fresher. The only tree is fresher still out in the field, right? And so that's a great way to get a fresh tree. But also if you go to a tree lot, a retail lot, just making sure that you're looking at the tree. I do the pull test. You grab one of the shoots, pull with your thumb and your forefinger, a good tug along the branches, and those needles should stay on. If you're getting needles coming off already, keep looking at another tree. But so fresh tree, get as fresh a tree as you can, fresh cut. And so what we're talking about there is when you bring a tree home, if it's been more than 2 or 3 days since that tree's been cut, say you do a choose and cut, and maybe it's was snowing or raining or whatever, and you want to set it in the garage for a few days before you set it up in the house, make sure that you cut off about an inch off the bottom of that trunk. And certainly if you're getting a tree from a lot, you definitely want to do this. And what happens is when you cut the tree, there's resins in that wood. And so that will tend to kind of occlude or plug up those xylem pores. The tree's basically like a big straw, right? And so what you want to do is make sure that the tree can take up water from the stand. So that fresh cut is important, an inch or so off the bottom.
Should you even do that with a tree that you've just taken cut from a ladder? Is that not, or from a tree farm?
If it's a choose and cut and you're going from the tree farm to the house and getting the tree up, you should be fine. But if it's around for a couple, 3 days or so before you get it up, it wouldn't hurt to take that little bit off the bottom there. And so fresh tree, fresh cut, and then the last thing is fresh water.
Fresh water.
And making sure that you've got a stand that's big enough. We always say a quarter water per inch of diameter of that trunk. Most trees are about 3 to 4 inches in diameter at that butt end or that bottom end. And so a stand should hold maybe 3 quarts to a gallon, which is pretty good size stand. But you want to make sure you got a big enough stand for the tree you're getting. And then keep fresh water in that. Don't let it dry out. And fresh trees especially will take up a surprising amount of water. And when I bring my tree in, I make sure that I check it every day, especially that first week or so. They will really, it's like, that giant sucking
sound.
Like
the straw you're
saying. You can hear them practically taking that water up, and that's good. And in fact, the more water it's taking up, that usually is a good indication that's a really fresh tree, and that's what you want. So keep that water to the tree. There's no need to add aspirin or 7-Up. You hear all these different sort of
all kinds
home
of
remedies
theories
out there. Really, the
I hadn't heard aspirin before.
there's several things, and they're on the internet and all of that. But really, the most important thing is just making sure you're keeping plenty of fresh water to that tree. Don't let it dry out. Making sure that give the finger test. Make sure you get down under there and check that periodically. I've rigged up a little thing at home. I've got a regular watering plant watering can there, and I just hooked a little piece of garden hose to it and stick that down in there.
Kind of have a siphon kind
of
thing.
Just fill it up every day.
Now, in terms of what people are choosing, I know there have been a lot of new varieties that have been over the last decade or so, but are the trends changing at all in Christmas tree purchases and what people are buying?
It's kind of leveling out in some respects. We saw a big change here in the Midwest and in Michigan over the last 20 years. Scotch pine used to be sort of the king and really what got our industry going here in Michigan in terms of Christmas trees. That has gradually sort of fallen off. But it's stabilized now. There's still a lot of tradition. Some people grew up with the Scotch pine, and that's what they want. But Fraser fir has kind of taken over a lot of that role. But that's kind of Michigan's claim to fame. We grow more types of trees than other parts of the country. If you're up in the Northwest, they're growing primarily noble fir. Down in North Carolina, they grow almost exclusively Fraser fir, whereas we're growing Fraser fir, Scotch pine, blue spruce, white spruce. We're seeing a little uptick in Black Hill spruce, which is actually a variety of white spruce. It's a very nice tree. It naturally has kind of a compact form. And so without really a lot of effort or shearing on the part of the growers, it makes a very nice-looking Christmas tree and has good needle retention, nice color, kind of a grayish green, really nice-looking tree.
If you wanted something a little bit exotic like a Black Hill spruce, it's probably good to call ahead then, because probably not all farms have those.
True. And the Michigan Christmas Tree Association has a very nice website. Just Google Michigan Christmas Tree Association. And they have a very nice website, and it actually has a map of the state that has all the choose and cut farms. You can just click on the little Christmas tree near your hometown, and it will give you the list of growers that are near you. And exactly, so a lot of them will list right on there their types that they grow, but certainly doesn't hurt to call and double check if you're looking for something a little bit out of the ordinary.
We're talking Christmas trees with Dr. Bert Craig, who's a Christmas tree expert from Michigan State University. Well, we talked about all the things, Bert, that you do. You get the tree into your home, how you take care of it. What about when you're disposing of the tree? What should our listeners know?
Well, the big thing is to make sure the trees don't end up in a landfill. And so many communities now have recycling programs. East Lansing, I know locally, and other communities around the country or around the state have even pickup locations. Also, a lot of places have drop-off where you can take your tree to a central location off in a park or something like that. And then the community will come back later. Those trees are usually ground up, used for mulch in the parks and whatever. So that's the main thing, is making sure that these things get recycled somehow. Some people leave them around their property. They make good bird habitat. If you've got an acreage, you can do that. Yep. And so lots of options there. But whatever you do, just make sure it doesn't end up in the landfill.
Well, let's hope there's a real good season for Christmas trees this year. Natural Christmas trees,
yep,
right?
I think there will be.
I've been talking with Dr. Bert Craig. He's a professor at Michigan State University's Department of Horticulture and Department of Forestry.
WKAR.
MSU, we love thy shadows.
Well, if I were to say MSU shadows, I'll bet most of you would rightly think of that lovely university alma mater. And you might even think of trees because of the well-known phrase from the song, "Beneath the Pines We'll Gather."
Well, beneath the pines we'll gather.
But how many of you would conjure up visions of equally lovely and elegant wood products? With me to talk about the MSU shadows you're probably not aware of is Dan Brown. Dan is a sustainable bioproduct specialist in MSU's Department of Forestry. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Give us some background on the origins and purpose of the MSU Shadows program.
We have many trees on campus, so they're cherished by our student body, our faculty. They are a teaching resource for our students within forestry and horticulture and other classes. So we bring down about 300 trees a year on campus. So safety concerns, disease, stress, drought, just urban stress in general, and some construction removal. So originally these trees were either chipped up and burnt in the power plant or chipped up and used as mulch. So either one of those end uses aren't a real desirable way to use these trees that we love so much. So we decided we could reclaim these trees and hopefully make a heirloom product that'll stick around folks' homes for a while.
Well, it's a lot of us have been around campus for a long time. Often wondered what happened. I mean, even this summer we've had a couple of pretty fierce storms blow through where you've lost some trees. I mean, what a sustainable way to repurpose those trees that have been blown over.
Yes. And it's a common problem across municipalities. So MSU wasn't the only one to get hit by the ice storm in 2013. We're not the only ones that get hit by this storm back in June. East Lansing got it. And a lot of their wood is at the same fate. Municipalities across the country are chipping up wood and either burning it. Some of it gets landfilled, unfortunately. So there is a movement to start utilizing urban wood.
Tell us a little bit about the broader umbrella program, the Sustainable Wood Recovery Initiative.
So the MSU Shadows Collection funds this program. So with those funds, we're hoping to plant more trees on campus. So we're completing the circle. So we have these trees that we love. We've you know, there's people been proposed to underneath these trees. We study under them. We love them. They grow up and they die, and then they were gone. So now we want to complete this circle. So part of the funds from this, the MSU Shadows Collection, is going to go back into planting more trees on campus, so continuing this resource that we have. And then the other portion of the funds are going to go into educational opportunities. So we've already integrated the mill and some of the programs into forestry classes right now. We hope to have a full-on forestry course, urban wood utilization, and going through the whole process from the tree coming down all the way to selling a product.
My guest is Dan Brown. He is a sustainable bioproduct specialist at MSU's Department of Forestry. We're talking about the MSU Shadows program. So we've talked sustainability from an environmental standpoint and from an economic standpoint. Let's talk about the dimension that we call sort of the social and cultural leg of the sustainability stool. Mm-hmm. This wood, once it's milled and kilned and all of that, goes to local artists.
Yes, so we are also supporting the broader community with this program. Right, currently, we are working with six different local artisans. The furthest out that we are going is Ann Arbor. We have one in Lowell, Brighton. So that's kind of the outside diameter of our reach right at the moment. But yes, we are working with outside folks, and they're creating awesome products. We try to pick out folks that have their own unique styles and can bring their own flavors to the table.
So here, MSU Trees are supporting local artists who make these products, in turn support the tree plantings on Michigan State's campus. You've
yes.
got a closed loop there
mm-hmm.
of sustainability.
And that was the idea, yep.
What types of products, and where can folks find out more about them?
Right now, we are selling our products to the MSU Surplus Store and MSUShadows.com. We hope to branch out later on in the future, but right now, that's where we're at. We kind of have the full gamut of products, so you can have a dining room table. So we have some great live-edge coffee tables. We have one of our artisans, he does a more mid-century modern look, so some real crazy-looking designs. We have a few Herman Miller-style tables, which are got a very unique story. Not only is the wood reclaimed on the top, but we've upcycled old Herman Miller table bases that were kind of laying around at Surplus. And so there's a sustainability story kind of plugged in twice to these tables.
And yeah.
we've revived one of his bases and right. thrown a new a reclaimed wood top on top. So you can get the big furniture, and then stepping down from that, we have diploma frames. We cater to bachelor's, master's, and PhD frames, and they come in a multitude of flavors, styles, and colors. We have cutting boards, wine bottle stoppers, pens, business card holders, cutting boards, so we kind of run the gamut on all the way around.
I spent some time on the website looking at some of the different products. I mean, they are lovely products, and they're made by Michigan artists, and they come from MSU mm-hmm. wood. What a great thing to frame a diploma, a card holder, a table, because it's a talking point around the house.
Yeah, and another great plug on the products is, Michigan State University, we have such a variety of trees that, you know, it's a teaching resource. We have trees that don't grow here, so we've made them grow here. So eventually they succumb, and we get that wood. So we have some species that you won't find on the commercial market in these products. And some of the colors and things that come out with the trees being stressed on campus is also unique.
Wow, so just things that you would not see.
Yeah, yeah. So many of our products you're not going to find at, you know, your box stores or local places.
And you're supporting tree plantings on campus.
Yes.
When you're buying those products, in
yep.
addition to the local artists.
Yep.
I mean, it sounds like a win-win-win.
That's what we're hoping to get here.
Okay, so the MSU Surplus Store, or go online to MSU Shadows for those wonderful, lovely products. I've been talking with Dan Brown. He's a sustainable bioproduct specialist at MSU's Department of Forestry, and he leads the Department of Forestry's input and coordination of the MSU Shadows program. Dan, thanks so much for being on the program.
All right, thanks for having me.
Sing our love for alma mater, and thy praises MSU.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today. Kurt Kwiatkowski is Michigan State University's executive chef. When it comes to trends in holiday eating, Chef Kurt says,
one of the biggest trends is the focus on the side dish. And instead of it just being one entree and one or two sides, now you're talking six, seven, eight different sides. And I think there's a great trend to being open to trying different things.
What are some of your ideas and or suggestions for how we can enjoy some of the traditional holiday favorites like a turkey or a ham and new in different ways?
You know, sometimes depending upon how many people there are, you don't have to cook a whole turkey and you don't have to cook a huge ham. You could just do a turkey breast. And one of the things I like to do with a smaller group of people, I take the turkey breast and kind of fillet it open, stuff it, wrap it back up, and then if you want to get crazy, think outside of the box, you can wrap it with bacon and cook it in the oven. You can leave the skin on it, but not overly difficult, and then you can have different portions. You know, I think trying different world flavors, I think that's another thing that's really coming in. Instead of your traditional, okay, I'm just going to roast a ham and I'm going to put some cloves in it and it gets pineapple. It's now we've got this bourbon Asian glaze or something along those lines, and I think you're making your food more exciting and more fun.
I'm getting hungry, Kurt, already as we talk. I'm wondering, too, do you have some ideas if people want to eat a little bit healthier at the holidays and kind of a second part of that? Or do you find that's a one time a year where people don't want to count the calories and the fat grams?
I think people say one thing and do something different. I personally try. I really try. It just doesn't always seem to happen, especially I think I do really well during the meal. And then the next thing you know, there come the desserts. And then I'm a sucker for chocolate. That's all I can say. I think if people are looking to do that, it comes in those side dishes instead of something that's just brown sugar and overly glazed with, you know, like your yams that are baked with sugar and molasses and syrup. Maybe you just oven roast those hunks of sweet potato and you can put Brussels sprouts with them. Or you can just put some Southwest seasonings on them and you make some French fries out of them. So just a little bit of a different twist.
MSU corporate chef Kurt Kwiatkowski is my guest on MSU Today. Kurt, I'm intrigued by your idea, too, of more side dishes, little bites of a lot of different things than maybe just a giant turkey or ham. But in relation to that, how about hors d'oeuvres? What do they play? What role are they playing now? Or suggestions you might have?
I think hors d'oeuvres are a big thing. You know, something as simple as shrimp cocktail. And it doesn't have to be a big bite. It can just be something super small, something really simple, even like a dip with some crostini that you're going to bake off in the oven and maybe some tomato bruschetta on top of it for when everyone gets there. Just, I think sometimes, too, it's that buildup. People come over and you're there for an hour or two and you're waiting to eat and you've got these smells that are going on and you're just so excited and, you know, that savoriness and you're kind of get mouth watering and your stomach saying, feed me, feed me, feed me, and you're holding off. And then when you finally do, you kind of get a little bit too much. And so if you get a couple of snacks ahead of time, kind of satiate yourself a little bit, and I think you're going to be better off in the end.
And Kurt, what about some wine or spirits suggestions that would complement all these great holiday food items?
You know, craft beers here in Michigan are huge. Right now, you got seasonal beers that are out. I think the Michigan wine industry plays a great part in it, too. I look personally for things that have good acid to them. Michigan makes some great bone dry Rieslings. You got Left Foot Charlie, J Trees, Black Star Farms makes some great, great crisp Rieslings, Gewurztraminers. So you've got this touch of sweetness, but some pepperiness and great acid. So it plays with a lot of different foods. So, and I think a lot of people would really enjoy things like that.
And Kurt, why, we want to keep everybody healthy this time of the year while they enjoy these great, delicious meals around the holidays. What about some food safety tips for people to keep in mind?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, if you're working with a raw product, try and cut all your vegetables ahead of time before you start working with that raw product and do a lot of the prep work, or do the raw product first. If it's a big, huge turkey that you're cooking for that holiday meal, go ahead and work with that turkey, rub it down, season it the way you want. Maybe it's a brine thing. Get that in the oven. completely sanitize everything. Wash your hands, wash your hands, wash your hands. And then sanitize everything in and around whatever that touched, the knife, the cutting board, the area around where you were working. So everything's super clean. And I think you're going to be a lot safer. And please, if you're making a turkey, don't put the stuffing inside of it. Cook it separately.
And what about another one, Kurt? People like to graze after the meal, but you really shouldn't leave things like turkey and a lot of the food out for more than a couple hours. Is that right?
Yeah. And try and get things kind of wrapped up. Only let it sit out for maybe 2 hours. Try and loosely wrap it. Get it into the fridge, and you should be a lot safer off having those leftovers afterwards.
And Kurt, people love to enjoy the leftovers at the holidays too. What's your advice on how long maybe things can be refrigerated that you're going to enjoy right away, or maybe in the freezer for things you want to pull out later?
Yeah, I'd say the freezer is going to be a really good bet for you. You're going to get about 90 days shelf life in the freezer. In the refrigerator, if it's a protein, 4 days is what I say is max. And if it's just vegetables, you can go that fifth, maybe sixth day. If it's looking a little funky, when in doubt, throw it out. I can't say that enough. And when you're going to freeze something, make sure the air's out of the bag when you're putting it in the freezer. And then from that same token, making sure that things are cooled down before you completely seal them when you're putting it in the refrigerator.
Kurt, what about a couple of favorite recipe sites? We didn't get that detailed here, nor is this necessarily the place to do that. But if people want to branch out, do something different, do you have a couple of favorite sites, or can you direct people places?
You know, for me, the internet can be a good thing and a bad thing. I personally look to different cookbooks, and I've got some of my chef friends, maybe not that haven't written the cookbooks, but have recommended different books to me. I collect a lot of cookbooks. From friends of mine, I know that Epicurious, I believe, is a site that a lot of people go to. And then it's always good to read the reviews on a site, especially because it may look like it's really good and maybe it's not really tested. So just, you know, user beware on any specific thing that you go to.
That's MSU's executive chef, Kurt Kwiatkowski, and you can keep up with him on Twitter at chef_Kurt. That's K-U-R-T. And I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
Salagadoola, metchagaboola, bibbidi-bobbidi. Put them together, and what have you got?
W-K-A-R.
MSU Ag Bio Research is really centered around leading research and developing scientific discoveries in the areas of food, energy, and environment.
Doug Bueller leads MSU Ag Bio Research.
Our history bases us in Michigan, but we've really expanded that mission to the nation and to the world.
MSU Ag Bio Research has more than 300 scientists representing 7 MSU colleges.
We're very interested in continuing to build international linkages because of the importance of what we do and the global nature of agriculture and the global nature of a lot of the problems that we currently face.
MSU Ag Bio Research is leading research and scientific discoveries in the areas of food, energy, and the environment in Michigan, the nation, and around the world.
The core is that we do research on food, energy, and agriculture. The reality is that those three things are important to everybody every day of their life.
Visit agbioresearch.msu.edu.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today. Establishing more endowed chair professorships is a key goal of MSU's Empower Extraordinary campaign, says MSU Provost June Pierce Hewitt. And the endowments are a key piece in attracting the best faculty talent to MSU.
Well, if you look across our endowed chairs and professors, they really represent some of the finest scholars, researchers, artists, not just in the country, but really internationally. And we have recruited them to MSU for their intellectual leadership. The endowment piece of this becomes very, very important for these individuals. It isn't, certainly it's the title, it's the recognition, and that's well-deserved. It's as if one is the first chair in the orchestra or the first string on the team. But the endowment that comes with it, the unrestricted funds to pursue work, becomes very, very important for people who are very good and very innovative. All of these people, I believe probably all without exception, certainly have their work funded externally by foundations and national organizations and governments, but government agencies, but people who are very, very capable and who are truly leaders often are out ahead of those funding agents. They have the big idea. They have the hunch long before the funding agent issues a request for a proposal. And so making sure that those individuals have those resources at hand to begin to work on the next big idea becomes very, very important.
I'm Deborah Verholden, and I am one of the C.S. Mott Endowed Professors of Public Health in the new Public Health Division in the College of Human Medicine located in Flint.
An endowed position is what enticed Dr. Verholden back to her hometown.
So being a C.S. Mott Endowed Professor, which kind of makes me laugh every time I say it, it sounds very important. But what it is the C.S. Mott Foundation, who is very invested in Flint, literally located a block from our building, got together with the community, MSU, and they did a comprehensive needs assessment, really looking at what are some of the greatest challenges that Flint faces, and how could a university foundation community partnership come together to address some of those challenges. So the endowment is important because it is the investment from the Mott Foundation to secure the positions to actually bring public health researchers and public health faculty here front line to help to deal with some of these challenges. So the endowment is the investment of the C.S. Mott Foundation and the future of public health in Flint.
Microbiologist Victor Derrida returned to his roots at MSU from the University of Michigan to assume an endowed position and chair a department. He says the private funding from donors...
It's absolutely essential, and not because of me, you know, I mean, but because I'm going to put away the Rudolph Hugh endowed chair side for now and adopt the Department of Microbiology and Molecular Genetics chair. Okay, so I'm competing for people all the time. I sort of think of myself as a general manager of a baseball team. All right, if we want to build strength, we can do it two ways. We can grow it in our farm system. We have some great outstanding assistant professors here that we want to make sure that they stay happy. Or we can go out and find it in the free agent market. And the only way to get the free agents onto the campus is to have endowed professorships. That is talk about anteing up. What are we anteing up to get somebody who's already established somewhere else? They've got what they want somewhere else, but an endowed chair can really make them pay attention. So if we're going to build strength, we have to do it by going to the free agent market and keeping the people that we have happy as well, the young people. So, by the way, once the people that we start out in our farm system start doing well, they start to look like people that can be poached by other places, so we have to have something in place for them. The endowed chairs are essential for that. They are absolutely essential for that. People get into my position eventually, you know, it's nice to have, you know, in your signature line to have that you're an endowed chair, this or that's kind of cool. We're building a team here, and building the team requires that we grow the farm system and that we hire free agents, and the way that we get free agents is with endowed professorships, not because Michigan State's not a great place, but because they're very happy where they're at. So what is it going to take to get them to move? An endowed chair is at least will start the engine. Doesn't mean it's going to happen, but there's no way I could seriously go after somebody or would who's already established somewhere else without going after them with an endowment.
They can go any place, often places where the winters aren't quite so harsh and the laboratories might be a little newer. And where there may be a few more fine restaurants within driving distance. And so one of the ways in which one recruits in that environment is to be able to offer an endowed chair professorship. Unfortunately, we have very few of those. We're celebrating those that we do have, and it truly is a celebration because we've done very well during this campaign. But we began this effort with the fewest number of endowed chairs or professorships in the Big Ten. Again, that makes it very difficult when one of our sister schools, a very, very good school, each of us want the same individual, and one of us can offer the status of a chair, the recognition of a chair, the funding of a chair, and the other cannot. And it's very difficult in that environment to go head-to-head with these good places. And so this is the advantage that makes all the difference. And there is something quite amazing about how one attracts talent, because one good person attracts another good person who attracts another good person. People very much want to work in the kind of environment where they have the kind of stimulation that comes from being surrounded by the best.
Al and Nancy Gambrell established an endowed chair professorship, and Al said at the recent investiture ceremony honoring faculty who recently received their positions that donors have varied reasons for creating this legacy.
For Nancy and me, it was all about helping our students to have the opportunity to learn from and to be inspired by our faculty, the best of the best. And that's exactly what happened to me about 40-some years ago. I was in a class with Dr. Larry Foster, who some of you might know, and he did a lecture on organizational behavior, and he really knocked it out of the park in my mind, and it made me, or led me, to be inspired to choose my career in human resources. And 40 years later, I would say that I'm still inspired by that, and so Nancy and I, when we found our way to Empower Extraordinary, we wanted to make sure that we were doing something that would allow for every student here to be inspired by great professors.
Having an endowment sends a clear signal to the researcher and to the professor that there's an investment, there's an at-stakeness. If you want to know where people's values are, you look to see where they spend their resources. So when people endow positions the way the Mott Foundation endowed these positions at Michigan State, it's a clear indication that this matters. And who doesn't want to be someplace where you know that you matter, where the work that you do is a key part of the value system of the institution? So the endowment does make a big difference. It's a signal both to the community that there's a real investment, but it's also a signal to the faculty member that we are here and we are investing in you.
Provost Hewitt says establishing endowed chair professorships will continue to be a focus of the Empower Extraordinary campaign.
We've emphasized throughout this campaign several priorities, but we probably haven't talked about anything more than chairs and professorships, because this is the quality of the institution. This is the ultimate investment. This is the way in which we assure that quality continues in this place. I've said to more than one donor, if you care deeply about making sure that an area of study is attended to by the very best and always attended to, no matter how funds flow, come and go, no matter how funding agencies shift in their priorities, if this is a priority in your life, if this is something you're willing to invest in beyond today, beyond to tomorrow, then investing in an endowed chair professorship is really probably the ultimate place to invest. It's a way to carry not just the area of work, but in many cases it honors their family. That's for whom the chair is named. We have others that are named in honor of a professor or a mentor that really helped shape their lives. It becomes a very, very high priority. We care a great deal about scholarships and fellowships for our students. That's an outstanding investment as well. But chairs and professorships really change the quality of the institution.
The endowment also creates a sustainability for positions. I mean, mostly we're a soft money world. You know, when you're a researcher, you're paid primarily from grants, which are soft money. And the tides, you know, change and turn, and you know people go into funding troughs, but with the endowment there is some sustainability and a basic infrastructure of support that does allow the faculty to have a certain sense of security and stability in their research programs, which does create opportunities to attract the nation's best and brightest students, postdocs, fellows, and recruit other faculty. So even within our division, we are actively in the search process for an additional 4 faculty to join us within the next year.
What really happens at universities, and what has to happen, is we discover new things in nature. And the research is slow, it's expensive, and it's the predicate for all of the discoveries that are going to be beneficial to people. But the basic science that gets done at universities like Michigan State is so important. And I think we sometimes mislead the public by suggesting that, oh, we made this interesting finding, and that's going to lead to this new drug or this new antibiotic. It may, but the important thing is that we made the finding. And this basic science that drives this findings is really, really important. And it's expensive, as I said, and it's always a challenge to say, here's the line between this finding and this cure. But we know the finding is important, and we're doing this investigation because we want to uncover how nature works. We know over the eons that we've been doing this that once we uncover how nature works, we'll be able to harness it and make it better for us. But we have to first uncover how it works, and that's the basic science that people sometimes get a little bit impatient with. And I think we drive some of that impatience by using university press to get our stories out there. Oh, I made this discovery, and it's going to lead to this. Mostly that's BS. I made the discovery, and that's what Michigan State exists for, is to make discoveries. We're an institution. We're a leading research institution. We want those discoveries to go and help people and change lives, for sure. But just the knowledge itself changes lives, and that's really important. So that's a key element that I try to get out whenever I talk to the public, that the basic I can tell you about really important things that we do today that we take for granted and maybe even therapeutically, but I can also I can point to several of those that started as very occult and cryptic observations that somebody made. This, hey, this is kind of neat. And then they got really interested in understanding why that happened the way it did, and ultimately it led to some discoveries. But the original science was done just because somebody was curious about how something works.
For more, please visit empower.msu.edu. I'm Russ White for MSU Today. Sundays at 4 o'clock, it's MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. MSU Today is a lively look at MSU-related people, places, events, and attitudes put into focus through conversations by MSU President Simon, Spartans A.D. Hollis, sustainability-focused Dr. Kirk Heinze, and me. MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR. Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.